At least 13 people are killed after an explosion occurs outside the Kabul International Airport. 3 U.S. troops are injured in the blast. Canada joins Belgium, Denmark, and Poland in halting evacuations from Kabul Airport amid heightened security risks. A Russian ambassador to the UK is warning that there will be consequences if Britain violates the Russian territorial waters near Crimea again. Welcome to World News here in the Iranian capital. I'm your host, Bashir Sanjafik. Good to have you with us. On top of our news this hour is Afghanistan. The Pentagon saying an explosion has occurred outside the Kabul International Airport where evacuation efforts are going on. American officials saying that the blast appears to have been the result of a suicide bomb attack. Unnamed U.S. officials saying that several American troops may have been injured. Meantime, the Taliban saying at least 13 people were killed, including children. The militant group says many of its guards have been wounded as well. Now, that happened after several Western countries warned about risks of an imminent terror attack in Kabul Airport, urging people to avoid the venue. Germany had also warned that departures have reached their most dangerous stage.
Right now, we are in the most hectic, the most dangerous, and the most sensitive phase. We know that the terror threats have massively increased and that they have become a lot more concrete. The foreign ministry informed the relevant people overnight that they should no longer make their way to the airport on their own.
The German defense minister described the situation around the Kabul airport as very difficult and dangerous. Canada, Poland, Belgium, and Denmark have all stopped their evacuations. Washington saying its operations will go on through the end of the month. The Taliban have refused to extend the deadline for the withdrawal of foreign troops beyond the August 31st deadline. Now let's go to the African capital, Kabul. Amin Alami, our correspondent, is watching all that's happening there. Amin, bring us up to date.
Well, Thursday evening was a deadly evening for Kabul as a huge suicide blast took place in front of the eastern gate of Kabul International Airport here in northeast of the capital. According to Taliban sources, at least 13 individuals, including women and children, were killed, and at least 3 other American soldiers were also wounded. Bad eyewitnesses who were close to the blast site told us that there were at least 20 people who had lost their lives, and more than 40 others were also sustained injuries. Just a few kilometers to our office, here is emergency hospital for the war victims. I talked to the officials in this emergency hospital as well. They said that we have received 25 injured individuals so far, and he also said that 5 of them have so far been lost their lives. In the meantime, the U.S., the U.K., and the European Union had already warned about the possible terrorist attack inside and around the Kabul International Airport. That is why they had asked all of their nationals and all those who were around the Kabul International Airport to urgently leave the area as there is the possibility of a huge terrorist attack. Just only hours after those warnings, we witnessed a huge blast there. But in the meantime, the situation is currently under the control of Taliban members who are guarding the Kabul International Airport. In the meantime, Taliban sources also confirmed that a number of the members have also sustained injuries who were in charge of protecting Kabul International Airport and who were stationed outside of this airport. In the meantime, there is no any other comment regarding to the continuation of the evacuation of foreign nationals and Afghan nationals from this key airport in the Afghan capital, Kabul. But the U.S. had already said that we are going to extend the evacuation program or the evacuation process from Kabul International Airport to other countries, a decision or a proposal that was rejected by the Taliban here, as the Taliban said that if the U.S. insist on extension of troops withdrawal beyond May 31st, it would have consequences for the U.S. troops here.
And I mean, is there any claim of responsibility for this explosion? I wonder if there is any. And who could it be?
No, there is none of terrorist groups that so far claimed responsibility regarding to this incident, despite there are at least 20 terrorist groups who are operating inside Afghanistan. But the Taliban blamed the Daesh terrorist group for launching such deadly attack on the entrance gate of eastern entrance gate of Kabul International Airport that claimed the lives of dozens of civilians and injured dozens more.
Okay, so keep a close eye on that. We may come to you at a later time. Thank you very much for that. Amin Alami, correspondent in Kabul. Now, Russia says that there will be consequences if Britain violates its territorial waters again. The Russian ambassador to the UK told the BBC his country would make it more difficult for British military vessels to enter its waters next time. Andrei Killen was referring to a June intrusion by the British naval destroyer HMS Defender into Russian territorial waters in the Black Sea. The Russian defense ministry said at the time that it had fired warning shots at the vessel off the coast of the Crimean Peninsula. Moscow also slammed Britain for violating international law, denouncing the move as dangerous and provocative. Britain, however, claims that the vessel was in the Ukrainian territory in accordance with international law. The U.S. continues its aggressive stance against China. Vice President's tour of Southeast Asia resembled more an anti-China tour than any other thing. Kamala Harris made every effort to rally nations around the region against China, and this at a time when the world is witnessing U.S.'s messy withdrawal from Afghanistan. How likely is it that nations in this region of the world want a military confrontation to happen in their own backyard?
The U.S. Vice President Kamala Harris has arrived in Vietnam as she continues the tour of Southeast Asia in an attempt to co-opt countries against China. Speaking in Hanoi on Wednesday, Harris said that there was a need to increase pressure on Beijing over its maritime claims in the South China Sea. She offered Vietnamese president support to counter Beijing in the South China Sea. We need to find ways to raise the pressure on Beijing to abide by the United Nations Convention on the Law of the Sea and to challenge its bullying and excessive maritime claims. Speaking in Singapore one day earlier, Harris had said that Beijing's use of what she called scare tactics in the South China Sea continued to undermine what she described as a rules-based order and threatened the sovereignty of other regional nations. Laying out the U.S. administration's foreign policy goals, Harris reiterated that Washington had enduring interests in the Indo-Pacific region and aimed to counter Beijing's aggressive advances, as well as to maintain freedom of navigation. Harris sought to assure America's Southeast Asian allies that growing U.S.-China tensions would not force nations that have strong ties with both countries to choose one side of the political equation. She said, however, that Washington would take the side of its allies in all of their territorial disputes with China.
Our vision includes freedom of navigation, which is vital to us all. The livelihood of millions of people depend on the billions of dollars in trade that flow through these sea lanes each day. And yet, in the South China Sea, we know that Beijing continues to coerce, to intimidate, and to make claims to the vast majority of the South China Sea.
Well, we know that the United States has little to no regard for international law and regulations. As a matter of fact, a couple months ago, there was an article published about the United States Coast Guard being in the Mediterranean. Now, mind you, why would the Coast Guard of the United States be in international waters unless the United States has no desire to keep international regulations and to follow international procedure?
Now, Beijing has responded to U.S. Vice President's anti-China statements with the same veracity. It's accused Washington of refusing to join the United Nations Convention on the Law of the Sea, while at the same time claiming to uphold the convention. It accuses the U.S. of recklessly intervening in Afghanistan, Iraq, and Syria under the pretext of protecting the interests of small countries.
In response to Harris's remarks, Chinese state media decried the U.S. vice president, accusing her of interfering in regional affairs by seeking to divide China and Southeast Asian nations To prevent Beijing's economic growth, China's state-run China Daily said in an editorial that while pointing a finger at China and accusing it of coercion and intimidation, Harris willfully ignored her own hypocrisy in attempting to coerce and intimidate regional countries to join Washington in a scheme to contain China. Seems that the United States' only commitment to Southeast Asia is its dedicated efforts to drive a wedge between the Southeast Asian nations and China. Meanwhile, China has accused Washington of bullying and hegemonic behavior. China's foreign ministry said that Afghanistan was one of the many examples defining what the U.S.'s so-called world order truly meant for nations.
The U.S. can come and go as it wishes and doesn't need to seek the international community's opinions, not even those of its allies. In order to defend America first, the U.S. can arbitrarily smear, suppress, coerce, and bully other countries and without paying any price. This is the order the U.S. wants.
The U.S. sees its rivalry with China as the biggest geopolitical test of the century. Southeast Asia has seen a series of high-profile visits by top U.S. administration officials, including the Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin, who visited Hanoi in late July. The visits have escalated tensions between the U.S. and China, which were already high due to a range of issues ranging from cybersecurity to human rights abuses. The South China Sea is a gateway to major sea routes, through which about $3.4 trillion worth of trade passes each year and contains huge gas fields and rich fishing grounds. China claims sovereignty over much of the strategic waterway and since 2014 has built artificial islands and reefs and installed military bases on them.
Now moving on, Iranian President Ibrahim Raisi says that tackling the COVID-19 pandemic and inflation are top priorities of his new government. He made a comment in the first official cabinet session attended by the ministers. He stressed the importance of the rule of law, calling on his cabinet to administer justice in different areas. The president also referred to the necessity of fighting corruption, saying that the people should feel improvements in all spheres of society. He noted that the country's new health ministry must take a different and comprehensive approach toward containing the COVID-19 pandemic. A meeting was held a day after all but one of Raisi's ministerial picks received a vote of confidence in Parliament.
After 5 days of marathon debates in Parliament over the credentials of President Raisi's cabinet choices, the final voting was held on all but one of the 19 proposed ministers won the Parliament's confidence. Parliament gave no confidence to Hossein Barghouti, the proposed education minister, with 76 votes in favor, 193 against, and 18 abstentions. In his address to Parliament, President Raisi said his cabinet will start its work as soon as the following day. He says he will not waste an hour to solve the country's problems.
After the vote of confidence is over, we will kickstart our activities with the new cabinet as of tomorrow. Our country is grappling with serious issues, and we must not waste even an hour to address them. Issues such as the fight against the coronavirus and the need to speed up nationwide vaccination will be on top of our agenda.
The ministers of defense, foreign affairs, and intelligence were among the nominees with the highest votes. Lawmakers say this signals that Parliament shares the same approach with the government over foreign policy and national security.
This is meaningful. It shows that Parliament will support the plans of the new ministers. And as the President says, the new cabinet will work throughout the day to solve the problems of the country.
Ibrahim Raisi handed his proposed cabinet lineup to Parliament 2 weeks ago, a week after he took the oath of office as Iran's new president. Legislators then started reviewing the credentials of the proposed ministers behind closed doors for a week and in the open sessions for the past 5 days. With just one nominee dropping out of the list, it seems that the new government will not face serious friction with Parliament in its job. Raisi now has 3 months to introduce a new name for education minister, and until then, a caretaker will be appointed to run the ministry. Yusuf Jalali from Iran's parliament.
Israel has threatened it may have to resort to launching military action against Iran to help the U.S. negotiate a new nuclear deal with Tehran. The regime's Minister of Military Affairs, Benny Gantz, has accused Iran of seeking to build a nuclear weapon. He said that military action must be considered as a plan B to prevent Iran from accessing the materials for nuke. Israel's chief of staff had also made a similar threat. Now that's happening as the Vienna talks aimed at reviving the 2015 Iran nuclear deal appear to have stalled. Iran has time and again rejected any renegotiation of the accord. Iran officials have on many occasions stressed that Tehran does not want a war, but it will make a crushing response to any likely aggression. In other news, Egypt has partially opened the Rafah border crossing with a besieged Gaza Strip. It will remain open in one direction for 3 days, and that's to allow stranded people to go back to the Palestinian territory. Egyptian goods and aid will also be allowed into the Strip. Egypt closed the crossing on Monday, citing security reasons following the recent escalation of hostilities between Israel and the Palestinians in Gaza. Rafah is a lifeline for people in Gaza who have been under a crippling Israeli siege since 2007. Cairo often makes unilateral decisions to close the border point under pressure by Israel. Japan has suspended the use of more than 1.6 million doses of Moderna's COVID vaccine over reports of contamination in some vials. Now that prompted several Japanese companies to cancel worker vaccinations planned for Thursday. The U.S. vaccine maker says the contamination could be due to a problem in one of the production lines at its manufacturing site in Spain. The Spanish pharma company Rovi, which bottles Moderna vaccines for markets other than the U.S., says it's investigating the issue that has appeared on a few batches bound for Japan. The decision to suspend the use of Moderna shots comes as Japan is battling its worst wave of infections driven by the Delta strain. Daily infections there exceeded 25,000 this month for the first time. That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
In the name of God, Salam, and welcome to the sixth episode of our series, Health Tourism. In this episode, we are going to the beautiful city of Yazd to introduce you the Infertility Research Center of this city. Please stay with us. The city of Yazd is one of the central cities of Iran and the capital of Yazd province, which is about 667 kilometers away from Tehran. It is the first brick city and the second historical city in the world after Venice, Italy, which is located in a wide, dry valley surrounded by Shirkuh and Kharanakh mountains of central Iran. Yazd, which literally means pure, is known as the house of worship, city of windmills, and the city of bicycles. The city of Yazd was registered as the first historical city of Iran in the UNESCO World Heritage List on July 9, 2017, due to its valuable historical architecture and intact traditional structure. This has attracted many tourists from all over the world to this beautiful city. There are many historical and scenic places to visit in Yazd, including the Jame Mosque of Yazd, the Zoroastrian Fire Temple, Amir Chakhmah Complex, and the Fahadan Historical Area, with its beautiful historical texture, dazzles the viewers. Yazd province, with its beautiful deserts, has become known as one of the destinations for eco-tourists and health tourists. The serene and calm desert is an ideal location for tourists who are interested in meditation and relaxation. Additionally, sand therapy in the desert is one of the best traditional methods for treating joint pain and arthritis. Thus, a visit to the deserts of Yazd can be highly beneficial to those who suffer from joint pain or arthritis. In addition to historical and natural attractions, the city of Yazd, with the benefit of the best hospitals and doctors that are unique in the West Asia region, has become one of the treatment destinations for many Iranians as well as health tourists from abroad. Infertility treatment, cardiovascular disease, and dentistry are among the areas that have received a lot of attention in Yazd. Dear listeners, in the continuation of the program, we will say more about the medical centers of Yazd and introduce you to one of these centers. Yazd province possesses more than 2,650 beds and 20 medical institutions and 159 health centers and other clinical and paraclinical facilities. In addition, the city of Yazd is home to many talented doctors and physicians, many of whom are world-renowned. Among them are Professor Abbas Aflatunian in the field of infertility, Dr. Sayed Mahmoud Sadr in the field of cardiology, and Professor Mohammad Bagher Olia in the field of rheumatic diseases. These medical experts are not just famous in Iran, but indeed they are world-renowned. One of the most important factors in Yazd's reputation in the field of treatment is the existence of fertility and infertility research centers and the treatment of gynecological diseases, which has made this city one of the medical hubs of Iran. Meanwhile, Yazd Reproductive Sciences Institute is one of the first infertility treatment centers in Iran and the West Asia region, which welcomes many couples from Iran and the world every year. Yazd Reproductive Sciences Research Institute is located in Safaye area on Timsar Falahi Street in this city. This research institute was put into operation in 1986, and the purpose of its formation was to establish superior technology in the treatment of infertility as well as the treatment of infertile couples who had to travel to European countries for treatment. The center is currently active in the field of education of capable people, implementation of research projects, and treatment of infertile couples, and is composed of different departments. The institute includes four centers in its research section, including the Infertility Research and Treatment Center, the Stem Cell Biology Research Center, the Recurrent Abortion Research Center, and the Recurrent Abortion Research Center Medical Nanotechnology and Tissue Engineering Research Center. Infertility Research Center of this institute was introduced at the end of 2021 as the scientific center of the country in the field of infertility and reproduction by the Deputy Minister of Education of the Ministry of Health and Medical Education of Iran. Also in 2002, this center was acclaimed as the Exemplar Research Center in Razi Research Festival. As mentioned earlier, this research institute works in the fields of treatment, education, and research. The medical department of the research institute consists of 5 different clinics, including gynecology clinic, nutrition counseling, genetic counseling, and andrology, which have been formed in different fields to solve the problem of infertility. Presence of competent experts in various specialties of this department, such as androcrinology, urology, obstetric surgery, and psychiatry, are the turning and distinguishing point of this complex from other infertility treatment centers. Also, the most up-to-date methods of infertility treatment, such as IVF, IUI, IVM, ICSI, microinjection, egg and embryo freezing, uterine and ovarian examination through laparoscopy and hysteroscopy, etc., in this center is employed. Yaz Reproductive Sciences Research Center has gained many achievements over the years, including the successful birth of the first baby by microinjection, the first baby by epididymis sperm and microinjection, as well as maturation of eggs in the environment outside the body and fertilization. The infertility center works in such a way that infertile couples, after being admitted, go to the clinics in this center and are examined by various specialists such as endocrinologists, urologists, and gynecologists to determine the reason for not having children. After the necessary examinations and initial tests, their treatment method is determined and the couples enter the treatment process. The international department of the center, which is in the process of obtaining an IPD certificate for its international department, also treats a large number of non-Iranian couples who travel to Iran from various Asian and European countries every year. Dear friends, for information or to receive admission, you can refer to the center's website at www.ssu.ac.ir or call 0098353-7258-410 and ask your questions to the head of this department, Dr. Nabi. To communicate via email, you can email your questions to ivf@ssu.ac.ir. Dear listeners, we have come to the end of the 6th episode of our series, Health Tourism. Until next program, goodbye and God bless. Doc Review.
Hello and welcome to Doc Review with me, Camelia Shambayati. In today's show, we're discussing Cowspiracy, directed by Kip Anderson and Keegan Coon. And joining me in the studio, we have Maria Duarte, who is a film critic for the Morning Star newspaper and who has also worked as a news journalist. And beside her is Anthony Hamilton, who is a vegan, SWP member and student activist. Now, Cowspiracy is a groundbreaking documentary that contends that industrial animal agriculture is the leading cause of deforestation, water consumption, pollution, and even plays a far greater role in global warming than the transportation industry. Cowspiracy manages to expose the capitalist nature and the privatization of the Western food industry, which seeks to protect private company owners and large environmental groups that link back to Congress.
Do you think there should be any concern of us making this documentary?
Of course. If you don't realize right now that you're putting your neck on the chopping block, you know, you better take that camera and throw it away.
It's an environmental disaster that's being ignored by the very people who should be championing.
Let's look at the fundamental problem here.
No one wants to talk about it.
Because they're membership organizations, you know, a lot of them. They're looking to maximize the number of people making contributions.
The leading cause of environmental degradation is...
We need to address that as well.
It's not up to the Department of Water Resources.
Hard to actually target, like, one thing.
I don't necessarily know what it is.
There's suppression and mismanagement of information everywhere that abounds.
It starts at the local level, but then it goes all the way to Congress.
When you consider the devastation it's having on our planet as well as the oceans.
And we're in the middle of the largest mass extinction of species in 65 million years.
And they can dictate the federal policies because they have so much political power.
And one of the largest industries on the planet with the biggest environmental impact. Trying to keep us in the dark about how it's operating.
That's the one thing no one talks about. Everybody goes around that.
Unfortunately, we are no longer able to fund your film project. We had a meeting, and due to the growing controversial subject matter, we have some concerns with Capitol L.
You're going up against people that have massive legal resources, and you have nothing.
A lot of people just keep their mouths shut because they don't want to be the next one with the bullet to their head.
I don't know that I would want to comment on that.
Well, welcome both of you to the show. Thanks very much for coming on. And I must say, I found this documentary to be very shocking, thought-provoking, and disturbing all at the same time. And you really do feel a great sense of urgency after watching this documentary to address environmental issues. Maria, if I could start with you as our guest film critic. This documentary was re-released a few years ago, but it's still highly watched and highly relevant to today. What was your take on it?
Well, very much so, and everything that you've mentioned, that and all the above and more, really. And it's quite an impressive first-time feature for these guys. And what they do, which is really interesting, is rather than going for meat eaters and putting them off, which is the obvious thing, they go for the environmental agencies and groups and basically question them as to why they aren't campaigning about this issue, which is greatly affects global warming. I mean, it's pretty shocking. What they also do is, through humour and sparing shock tactics, get the message across too.
He's also on a personal journey, as we learn watching this documentary. He gets very involved, and I thought that was a good style.
Yeah, we've seen it with Michael Moore, but here it's less about him and more about keeping on point and on the question. And some of the stuff is really jaw-dropping.
We'll see that a bit later on. And Anthony, what was your take on the film?
Yeah, I mean, I really enjoyed it. Like you said, about the lack of shock tactics really then allows you to engage in it without feeling as if you're morally obliged to, you know, have to straight away get behind it without seeing the facts and figures and everything like that. So I thought in that sense, you know, it was quite good. It was very critical of the charities, of the people who are supposed to be doing something about this. It was very critical about the lobbyists as well behind it, trying to show the systematic nature of what's going on. I also do think there were a few problems with it. He does seem to pose a lot of the climate change activists against a lot of what he's actually trying to find out, which I think is, you know, a dangerous pit to fall into. In that he seems to target the people who are challenging climate change already, and the, you know, activists against fossil fuels and things like this, as being part of the problem because they're not acknowledging so much the, you know, the stuff around the agriculture industry. And I think it's a bit of a problem. A better way to do it would be to actually link the two together and say this should be a united fight.
But of course, he implies in the documentary that they're sort of in cahoots, perhaps behind the scenes with the political establishment, and that's why they're afraid to speak on this issue. But we'll talk about that a bit more later on as we show the clips in regard to that part of the program. So, Maria, if I could just turn to you. Do you think, before watching this documentary, were you aware that the animal agriculture industry had such a profound effect on global warming?
No, I wasn't. And having seen Al Gore's two films, even less so, because he doesn't tackle it either. And in the film, he is the main inspiration for Kip Anderson. And if this is as important, as huge as these filmmakers are saying, and the film is trying to say, then why aren't the likes of Al Gore tackling this or mentioning it, even just one line in his two films?
And Anthony, I mean, before we move on to our next clip, do you think this documentary at least makes meat eaters think twice and think about becoming vegan perhaps?
Yeah, I think it definitely has that, because it shows about, you know, there's a lot of talk about individual responsibility and things like that, but he does break it down in quite very obvious terms. He uses a lot of nice infographs and stuff, which actually shows your impact on the world, the impact of the meat industry and so on. So I think it does actually, it's really good at exposing that and actually showing people the evidence and letting them make their choice for themselves as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, we'll have to leave it there just for now.
Clearly, the government did not want to talk about this issue. Their inability to answer, along with the environmental organization's silence on the topic of animal agriculture, made it seem something more was going on. I started doing more investigating on the impacts of livestock and found out the situation was actually worse than I had thought. In 2009, two advisors from the World Bank released an analysis on human-induced greenhouse gases, finding that animal agriculture was responsible not for 18%, as the UN stated, but was actually 51% of all greenhouse gases, 51%. Yet all we hear about is burning fossil fuels. This devastating figure is due to clear-cutting rainforests for grazing, respiration, and all the waste animals produce. This makes animal agriculture the number one contributor to human-caused climate change. But not only that, I found out raising animals for food consumes a third of all the planet's fresh water, occupies up to 45% of the Earth's land, is responsible for up to 91% of Amazon destruction, is a leading cause of species extinction, ocean dead zones, and habitat destruction. Yet, the world's largest environmental groups that are supposed to be saving our world didn't mention this anywhere. I had to speak with environmental organizations to find out why they weren't addressing this issue.
Truly some mind-boggling statistics there. Maria, if we could go back to you, do you think the filmmakers were successful in this film in conveying the threats the environment is under?
I think they were. For me, the most shocking was the fact that Greenpeace wouldn't speak to Kip Anderson, which is just mind-boggling. And why these organisations aren't fighting or bringing these subjects onto, you know, tackling the government over it, but that sort of Michael Moore-ish type sort of assault on the Greenpeace's offices spoke volumes. And then the emails that the correspondence that he received saying, oh, we're not this time, you know, not we can't help you this time. You know, when this is, you know, a great opportunity for them to talk out, you know, to speak out and say something.
And Anthony, if I could turn to you now and to address the issues, the main issues raised in this documentary. Of course, what is the link between the animal industrial agriculture industry and also the impact it has on global warming?
Well, I mean, a lot of what was just shown in that clip there, you know, the deforestation, the destruction of habitats, the species extinction, all of these things contribute in a major way. And if you consider this industry, it is an industry. It has, you know, huge, huge amounts of waste, huge amounts of pollution, huge amounts of taking up land simply to grow crops to feed the animals who also take up land as well. It's an incredibly destructive cycle that actually does, you know, I mean, it was very interesting when he spoke to the Oceana person and they said about ethical fishing and so on, but I mean, when he goes through it in detail, there's not really such a thing as the sustainable fishing which they talk about. Mm-hmm. Every which way in which the industry constantly expands is destructive.
It is a myth, that's what he suggests in the documentary, which is surprising to hear. So are you suggesting, is there a link between capitalism and global warming? I mean, do you think it's our over-consumer society that is to blame for all these unsustainable methods we're taking?
Absolutely, and if you think about, the entire fundamental point in capitalism is about overproduction. It's about constant expansion, finding new fields and areas to be able to conquer and dominate and sell to people. And if you look at the meat industry, the agriculture industry, it is one of those industries which is just growing bigger and bigger and bigger every year. And, you know, with globalization comes that then domination of the globe with this, you know, huge empire behind it, huge amount of lobbyist money. I think that's, you know, he goes and challenges a lot of the leaders of, like you said, Greenpeace and so on. I think that's brilliant because holding them to account over it really shows the power that this industry has behind it as well.
Marie, do you think the filmmaker puts off people who eat meat from taking part in helping the environment, or do you think he does it in a way that's clever for us to help the environment?
No, I think he was quite clever in the way he put it across, because we've seen in other films, you know, where, you know, you see these animals and the way they're treated and the inhumane conditions and everything. But here he's showing what the consequences are and the effects to us and to our planet and what we're doing, and it does make you sort of self-conscious about it. And I think meat eaters will think twice whether or not they'll turn vegan is another matter, but they will take a harder look at what we're doing to our planet.
I mean, we're told constantly to use less water, to change our light bulbs, to recycle. And Anthony, I mean, shouldn't the onus be on the people in positions of power rather than the individual to help combat climate change?
Completely. I mean, the idea about just doing small individual things like taking shorter showers and switching off lights and things, while, you know, it is a good activity to get into, it's not going to create the fundamental change which is actually going to save the planet. The fundamental change needs to come from these mass organisations. It actually needs to come from system change in reality, because the way in which this industry is set up, it is to make profit, it is to expand, and it is to not look at the side effects of what they're actually creating, the consequences, which is, you know, constant heating of the globe, constant destruction of rainforests and so on.
And as this documentary suggests also, when you're up against this mass production machine, it's really futile trying to help the environment on an individual level.
I couldn't understand why the world's largest environmental organizations were not addressing this when their entire mission is to help protect the environment.
But that's the thing, too, as they say, you know, you use less coal, ride your bike,
Yeah, I think they think it's. I think they focus grouped it, and it's a political loser. In terms of, yeah, because they're membership organizations. You know, a lot of them. They're looking to maximize the number of people making contributions, and if they get identified as being anti-meat or challenging people on their everyday habits, that's something that's so dear to people that it will hurt with their fundraising.
They do not want to address the primary driving cause of environmental devastation, which is animal agriculture, because they're businesses and they want to make sure that they have a reliable source of funding.
I had invited to a meeting with Al Gore and some years ago now, and made these methane arguments, and he was really pushed back. And that's just his argument. It's hard enough to get people to think about CO2. Don't confuse them.
I think that the problem with a lot of organizations that are focused and have a laser focus don't go off message because they don't want to piss off another whole group of people that will make their lives difficult.
Maria, so if animal agriculture is a leading cause of global warming, why has there been so much silence about this issue? I mean, do you think, as the documentary suggests, there's a conspiracy or cowspiracy happening here?
Well, clearly something's happening, and there's a lot of invested interest, according to the film, because the fact that environmental agencies aren't taking up the cause, and that comment about Al Gore was priceless. You know, he's in a great position to have included that in his follow-up to An Inconvenient Truth in An Inconvenient Sequel, and he didn't touch it.
They mentioned that in this documentary, actually, that even Al Gore allegedly didn't want to go there as a politician. He knew that it wouldn't help the cause.
But you have to make it the cause. That's what I couldn't get my head around, you know. And that's the thing about this filmmaker. He keeps on message, and he keeps telling you this, and he keeps showing you, talking to all these different organisations. You know, I understand lobbyists. I would expect that from them, and to some extent from the government. But from environmental groups, you know, that was the shocker.
I was very surprised to watch that also. And Anthony, do you think, as the documentary suggests, that major environmental groups are purposefully turning a blind eye to the effects of animal agriculture on the environment. I mean, do you think they have any vested interests?
It seemed that way. I mean, from the people he tried to talk to, it was constantly evading his questions. There were times when people, they just went silent and couldn't actually answer his questions. You could tell that they wanted to say something, but it was as if something was stopping them. And I think, you know, there is an unseen power that lies behind these industries, where that pressure, that level of fear that the charities hold over being able to speak out about it is clearly an incredibly pressing issue on them. And I think at the heart of it, one of the things which someone said in the BT just there was that they are businesses and they have funding. And if you look at Kip making this film, he had his funding pulled halfway through the film because they said it was becoming too controversial. You know, as soon as these people, the agriculture industry, feels as if something is going to crush their profits and stop their profits in any way, they straight away jump on top of it and stop it from happening.
And another
interesting was that he tackles one of the pro-agriculture people and says, have you invested money? Have you funded Greenpeace or one of those organisations? And she, like, stops dead and says, I'd rather not answer that question, or something along those lines, which kind of suggests that they do.
It speaks volumes. So either they plead ignorance or they're trying to hide something. And Maria, one of the other shocking things we find out from this documentary is the food disparagement law, which effectively gags people from speaking out against the animal industry. In several states, it's a law that makes it easy for food producers to sue their critics for libel. So who knew speaking against the beef industry would land you in so much trouble?
Indeed, yes, that's $64,000 question. The fact that they went after Oprah and lost, again, speaks volumes to a certain extent. And the fact that she was sued along with Howard Lyman, who says in the film that if that had happened now, speaking the truth, he would have been, he would have lost.
He would have lost, yes. So he's probably lucky that Oprah was behind him on that.
Exactly, or that the Patriot Act wasn't around at that time, maybe.
Were you surprised to know this also, Anthony?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, the person who was sued as well alongside Oprah, he himself had ran a farm.
massive
farm. And it was him who then actually realised what was going on behind the scenes and tried to speak out about it, just speaking the truth. Mm. And straight away it was clamped down on. And obviously he doing that was an individual. Then it becomes the onus of what are these organisations doing? Actually, they have the clout behind them. They have the membership. They have the power to do something. Mm. So it does actually make you think what is going on behind the scenes.
We'll have to pause you there for now.
The animal agriculture industry is one of the most powerful industries on the planet. I think most people in this country are aware of the influence of money and industry on politics, and we really see that clearly on display with this industry in particular. Most people would be shocked to learn that animal rights and environmental activists are the number one domestic terrorism threat, according to the FBI.
And why is that?
It's a difficult question to answer, why these groups are at the top of the FBI's priorities. I think a big part of it is that they, more than really any other social movements today, are directly threatening corporate profits. You know, when we try to find out how factory farms and how animal agriculture is polluting the environment, they try to claim exemptions to that information, either under national security terms or public safety, trademark issues, business. It's a business secret. We've seen all these attempts to keep people in the dark about what they're actually doing. You know, one of the largest industries on the planet with the biggest environmental impact, trying to keep us in the dark about how it's operating. Through the Freedom of Information Act, we obtained documents from the Counterterrorism Unit that show they were monitoring my lectures, media interviews like this one, my website, my book.
Are we at risk filming this and showing it?
You're going up against people that have massive legal resources. I mean, it's just overwhelming, the amount of money at their disposal, and you have nothing. And I think that fear is a big part of the tactic as well.
Will was right. I was scared. When I learned about the activists being killed in Brazil, I was disturbed, but I felt removed. But to learn about American activists and journalists being targeted by the industry and FBI, my funding being dropped, I was genuinely worried, and it hit close to home. Was this why no one was willing to talk about the issue? I decided to take precautionary measures with all the footage I shot.
We also learn from the documentary that at least 1,000 environmental activists have been killed in Brazil over the last 20 years. Maria, we see Kip Anderson becoming increasingly more nervous and paranoid in the making of this documentary because of what he's up against as he digs deeper. Do you think the filmmakers were brave in making this film?
In some ways, yes. Because once you put your head above the parapet, then, you know, you're in that danger zone. And it's something that's very important and it's critical that people know about it. So, you know, kudos to them and to him to carry on with making this film, because it's such a vitally important subject. You know.
Do you really think that their lives were at risk, or were they dramatising it, perhaps?
It's not for me to say. It's hard to say. The fact that the funding was removed, and the fact that the FBI apparently, you know, targets journalists, isn't a surprise as such. But I don't know that. Verdict's still out on that one.
And Anthony, if we hear that, according to the FBI, environmental and animal rights activists are considered the number one domestic threat. Were you surprised to know this?
I was incredibly surprised, yeah. I mean, given how explosive the world has become, given how turbulent the times that we live in are, if you consider, I mean, you know, this film was made a few years ago, but there are still so many other pressing issues, where there are mass movements about it, where there are protest groups, where there's everything. It's a surprise to see environmental activists and you know, activists against the agriculture industry being up there at the top. I mean, a lot of the time these are people who are in small groups until it breaks through into a much larger thing, like maybe the People's Climate March and that sort of stuff. But until that happens, they're very small groups of people, so it is quite a shocking thing to hear.
I want to bring in Donald Trump now as we end near the end of the programme. I mean, he's been criticised for not taking climate change seriously, and he has a record of making some bold tweets, and he's even claimed in one tweet that perhaps China is responsible for global warming as some sort of conspiracy against the US. Anthony, what do you make of Trump's environmental policies?
I mean, I just don't think he knows what he's talking about, really. He has access to a social media account which has possibly the biggest platform in the world right now, and he's able to say whatever he wants, whatever pops into his head at any time without listening to any advisors. And really, it just seems like he doesn't know anything that he's talking about, and everything is always an external enemy. He never does anything wrong. There's nothing wrong with the United States. You know, when it comes to Kim Jong-un and North Korea as well, it's them who are the aggressive ones with the missiles and everything like that. So it's always, there's someone else that's the problem, and it's he's never able to look inwards.
And Mary, what would you say the ultimate message of this documentary is?
Well, that we should all turn vegan, really, if we want to save the planet.
So cutting out meat or eating less is not enough, apparently.
Apparently not.
To reverse the damage that has been caused. Well, I'm afraid it was a really great discussion, but we'll have to leave it there for now. And that's it for this episode of Doc Review. And thank you to both my guests and to you. I've been Camila Shambiati.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Badr 5, and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.